What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life?
In the 1960s, radical change came to American poetry.
Women have been liberated to write about anything they want to.
I am the history of rape. I am the history of the rejection of who I am.
I'm Meryl Streep. Join me for A Change of World, Poetry in the Women's Movement.
And I'm Curtis Fox, the producer of that documentary. It's based on a series of podcasts that the Poetry Foundation has been putting out over the past year or so. If you want to hear the Meryl Streep narrated special, check with your local public radio station to see if it's on the schedule. If it's not, please ask them to carry it. It's free to stations, and it's on PRX, Public Radio Exchange. I'll remind you about this at the end of the podcast. Now, here's episode 4 of the podcast series, A Change of World, which originally dropped in November of last year.
You are what is female. You shall be called Eve. And what is masculine shall be called God. And from your name, Eve, we shall take the word evil. And from God's, the word good. Now you understand patriarchal morality.
That was Judy Gron with a poem from 1977, and this is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, A Place of Permission. In the 1950s and early 60s, if university students read female poets at all, it was usually confined to Anne Bradstreet and Emily Dickinson. If a woman wanted to become a poet herself, there were few models, fewer mentors, and only a handful of creative writing programs in the country. But by the 1970s, ambitious and socially progressive literary women were taking matters into their own hands. Poetry workshops run by women for women sprang up in cities around the country. They became communities unto themselves, and often they mirrored what was happening in the women's movement. This is part 4 of our series, A Change of World, about the intersections between contemporary poetry and second wave feminism. In this episode, we're looking into this new path into poetry.
When I was a student at Sarah Lawrence, I had a many very difficult times. That was when I discovered that poetry was a way of saving my life by helping me to, in some ways, forget it by writing.
This is tape from 1979 of poet and novelist Alice Walker, taken from a reading she gave at the Library of Congress.
I wasn't thinking about publishing these poems. I was just thinking about getting through the night. And so I put them all in a little blue notebook. And this little blue notebook I stuck under the door of Muriel Rukeyser's cottage. She was the poet on campus. And Muriel took these poems and gave them to her agent, who gave them to a publisher, and that was how I started publishing.
Alice Walker graduated from college in 1966. The support she got from an established female poet was rare at that time, if only because there were almost no prominent female poets to be found in universities. Even Muriel Rukeyser didn't have a tenured academic job. If you really wanted to study with her, though, you could find her in New York City.
In the human cities, never again to despise the backside of the city, the ghetto, or build it again as we build the despised backsides of houses. Look at your own building. You are the city.
Despisals is a poem by Rukeyser that turns the marginalization of urban groups into a metaphor for sexual and bodily shame.
Among our secrecies, not to despise our Jews, that is, ourselves, or our darkness, our blacks, or in our sexuality, wherever it takes us.
Rukeyser had been writing poems with a distinctly feminist perspective since the 1930s. In the 1960s and 70s, she was celebrated and championed by poets involved in the women's movement.
Never to despise the homosexual who goes building another with touch, not to despise any touch, each like himself,
like herself,
each.
You are this.
Among her readers in New York was an upcoming poet who would herself be celebrated one day for her own sexually frank poems, Sharon Olds.
She had lived a whole life in a female body. Therefore, she knew 1,000 things that I knew, and then she knew another 1,000 I didn't know. And she was bisexual, so she knew a lot more than I knew.
In the body's ghetto, never to go despising the asshole, nor the useful shit that is our clean clue to what we need, never to despise the clitoris in our least speech, never to despise in myself what I have been taught to despise, not to despise the other, not to despise the it, to make this relation with the it, to know that I am it.
She was brave. In a way, it was more important to me that she was brave. And that has something to do with me growing up in an atmosphere where women were, although women had to be quite brave in many ways, weren't known for that quality.
Perhaps because role models were scarce and mentors even scarcer, Olds didn't get serious about her poetry until she was 30.
I had a big breakthrough and I started writing all the time. And I began to realize that I needed help. My poems were too sentimental. They were sort of self-pitying. I didn't know how to revise without taking out the rude stuff, which was not necessarily what I should take out of my poems. It might be, but it might not be. And I just happened to see in a newspaper, when I didn't read the newspaper, Muriel Rukeyser, Poetry Appreciation.
In the 1970s, Rukeyser taught a poetry class at the 92nd Street Y in New York City.
What I needed was Muriel.
When Olds took the class, it wasn't a workshop where students brought in their own poems.
I don't think they had workshops yet, except maybe at Iowa. She would bring in a poem and ask someone to read it, and then ask someone else to read it. She was good for the ear, I'm realizing. And then she would say, let's see if we can reconstruct the first line. It was like great talk with poets.
One day, the students were allowed to bring in one of their own poems, and Sharon Olds was ready.
It was a sexual love poem. One of my fellow members of the class said, I don't know what's wrong with this poem, but something is really wrong with it. I don't know, all this milky and creamy. Muriel said, too dairy. Too dairy. I mean, I knew as soon as I was in the room with her that she was really important to me. She was so smart, so strong, so musical, so political.
And she was that rare model for how to be a female poet in a male-dominated literary scene.
She was of an age that she had suffered, much worse sexism than was there when I came along. When I came along, it was amazing how much there was. There was plenty. I got a lot of rejection slips from editors who were all male, many of which were contemptuous, and a couple of which were scary.
Olds thinks that their contempt was because her poems featured a woman's experience from a female point of view, woman-centered poetry, as it came to be known.
These were love poems, many of them, and they had children in them. And the editor would say, if you wish to write about your children, may we suggest the Ladies' Home Journal? We are a literary magazine.
The problem for up-and-coming female poets wasn't just rejection by male literary gatekeepers. It went deeper than that. As Honor Moore explains, she and other poets wanted to find their poetic voices as women.
Can I please, please put a pen in my hand and write what I really mean? Can I possibly find language for that? Well, where am I going to find the language? Where have poets always found language? By listening to other poets and making a shift.
I am a woman in the prime of life, driving her dead poet.
My lover's teeth are white geese flying above me.
Once it was easy to know who were my people.
Okay, I did not say male or female.
It was something ineffable that came out in the poems that everybody would respond to. I want to know that aspect of myself that this woman has freed within herself. What the poet was hitting that had to do with women's lives that had not yet been spoken. And you try and get to know the poet. Oh, I want to talk to that poet. I want to know what she knows.
This is a poem of a young child, a dark house, that time.
And then you might hear that, you know, Muriel Rukeyser was giving a workshop in her apartment.
Back then, pre-internet, pre-email, it was word of mouth. You might have heard that Audrey Enrich was holding a workshop in her New York apartment, or that Eileen Miles was teaching at the Poetry Project, or you might have seen a flyer saying that Honor Moore was giving a workshop in her apartment.
When I taught a workshop in my living room in 1977, I had this crazy idea that women poets wrote short lines because they didn't have the courage to write long lines. So I got everybody to write long-lined poems. But we were talking about getting our own experience into poems.
We had aroused this leaping giant of women who had so many stories to tell.
Judy Gron credits the women's movement for the surge of interest in writing workshops.
It was phenomenal. It was just like a flood. Women wanted to tell their life stories. They wanted to tell stories about things that had happened to them or had happened to their mothers or had happened to other people that they knew.
Gron was a lesbian activist in California who wrote poems that were very influential among feminists and feminist poets. She began giving workshops at feminist retreats in upstate New York in the 1970s and later in the Bay Area.
Well, I started working with the idea that we have a very powerful inner critic that is their mothers or their fathers or their very first teachers, telling them that they don't have anything to say, they're not worth anything, they're not articulate, they can't write, doesn't matter anyway. These awful voices, and I had such a voice as well, but I learned how to help people through it by addressing it directly, because otherwise it just sneaks up on you in the dark.
Gron says she also tried to help women in very practical ways.
I helped them set up special places in their house to sit every single day and say that this was their time, playing music that was just theirs, lighting a little candle that was just for them, having a notebook that was just only theirs. I think what made it work was that absolute permission to come up with anything they wanted to talk about and write about.
It was akin to consciousness raising. In other words, it was to find in our own lives as women the subject matter that was forbidden in other workshops, not only taught by a male poet, but populated by, let's say, 10-to-1 men to women.
The content, as I discovered, women's content was and still is to some extent so controversial and so unheard of. It was such a new thing.
I have been raped because I have been wrong. The wrong sex, the wrong age, the wrong skin, the wrong nose, the wrong hair, the wrong knee.
You know, there's always a big question, is this a poem? Especially if you're starting. Why would you write a poem if you're just going to write them like everybody else? So you're going to do something new. So you start that way, and then you want somebody to say, yes, this is a poem.
It's validating.
Validating, exactly. That's the word we would use now. But we didn't have that word then. All that 1970s validating and support group and all that stuff, that all really came out of the women's movement.
In the late 1970s and early 80s, Master of Fine Arts, or MFA, programs were rapidly becoming the standard path to becoming a poet. This helped democratize poetry, bringing more women into close contact with established poets and writers. At the same time, more female poets were finding jobs in these programs. Much of the feminist workshop scene followed these poets to colleges and universities.
I never imagined that MFA programs would suit or support women. In fact, they have, and it's because of individual women within MFA programs.
For those of us who live at the shoreline,
standing upon the constant edges of decision.
Audre Lorde taught at Hunter College in New York City. In 1980, someone gave Donna Messini something Lorde had written.
And for some reason, it really spoke to me. So I was at an Audre and Rich reading at the Public Theater. And for some reason, it was a benefit for this woman's theater group. And I was pouring drinks, and someone said, "There's Audre Lorde." And I just put down the bottle of wine, walked over to Audre, and just started talking. And Audre, as she always was with me, said, I understand. Come and study with me."
The problem was, Messini wasn't a poet. Nonetheless, Audre Lorde persuaded her to take her poetry workshop at Hunter.
There was no difference between the world and the poem. Audre would walk in and say, "Eleanor Bumpers." I'd say, "Who?" And Eleanor Bumpers, she was that old black woman who was killed by the police. And, you know, Audre would come in and she would talk about that. She would look at us and say, one time she looked at me and said, "Who minds the quartz that's on that watch you're wearing?" I was like, "Quartz? I didn't know there was quartz on a watch." You know, but she made us think about those things.
Even in the academy, workshops like Audre Lorde's helped to foster close relationships between women that could be life-changing.
Pretty early on, she grabbed me and said, "Come to my office." And she said, "You are a poet." I was like, "What?"
This was the beginning of a mentorship that turned Donna Messini into a poet.
At that time, she was living on Staten Island, and that's where my family was. She said to me, "Now you have two mothers on Staten Island, a black one and a white one." And she really, she was almost worse than my own mother. She was really, really tough, but she gave me the permission. And I think the sense that whatever you did, it had to be urgent and necessary.
I was born in Boston in 1949. I've never wanted this fact to be known. In fact, I've spent the better half of my adult life trying to sweep my early years under the carpet.
In 1992, tongue planted firmly in cheek, the poet Eileen Miles ran for President of the United States as a write-in candidate. One of her campaign stops was Wesleyan University, where Maggie Nelson was a student.
It wasn't a reading kind of at the sanctioned college spot. It was in like the hippie dorm where the kegs were and stuff.
I traveled widely. I met the famous, the controversial, and the not so admirable. And I knew from a very early age that if there were ever any possibility of escaping the collective fate of this famous Boston family, I would take that route.
She was doing an experiment with memorizing her poems and then delivering them kind of like campaign speeches, and her campaign slogan was radical disclosure.
I thought, well, I'll be a poet. What could be more foolish and obscure? I became a lesbian. Every woman in my family looks like a dyke, but it's really stepping off the flag when you become one.
She's pretending to be a Kennedy who has stepped off the flag in the guise of a poor dyke so that she won't be recognized.
A woman I was currently having an affair with said, "You know, you look like a Kennedy." I felt the blood rising in my cheeks. People have always laughed at my Boston accent, confusing large for lodge.
It was very unnerving in a way because it wasn't like a poetry reading with somebody at a podium who was looking down all the time. She was just standing there, you know, in her raw body, just telling us these things.
"Everyone here, are we all normal? It is not normal for me to be a Kennedy, but I am no longer ashamed, no longer alone. I'm not alone today because we are all Kennedys, and I am your president."
And then, you know, I just thought, well, whoever that was, it's time to follow it.
After college, Nelson did just that. She moved to New York and started taking workshops with Miles. The other students were poets and artists from various disciplines. There were a few men, usually gay or genderqueer.
They were pretty free of heterosexual dynamics in a certain way.
In the workshops, they'd usually do a writing exercise.
For a while, she was into this idea that, like, why do we always look at women nude models and write? So for a while, she was having men come nude that we would write about, you know, for like 15, 20 minutes, male nude models. We did that. We would do sometimes we would do walking meditation. So I remember, I mean, there's a poem in my first book that came from a walking meditation through Times Square. And we'd just go walk in Times Square for half an hour and then come back and write about everything we saw.
When Maggie Nelson was taking workshops with Eileen Miles, the feminist poetry workshop scene had been happening for 20 years. Most of it was now happening on campuses, yet there were pockets outside of academia where it persisted. The literary old boys club that female poets had faced in the early 70s was still strong, but by the 1990s, partly because of the workshops and the relationships they fostered, there were alternative ways to find support and develop careers. Maggie Nelson's experience in the 1990s was very different from female poets of the 1970s.
What I never had, I guess I'll say, is a poetry world where I felt like men were the gatekeepers or had things I wanted. You know, I wanted the world that Eileen represented. It was the kind of power that you create when you're making your own world, you know. And so we were making the world that we wanted and living in it, but we weren't asking anybody for anything.
Once again, Donna Messini.
I still think there's a boys' club when somebody decides who's going to be invited to read. The first names that come up with men are often men. But it has changed a lot. I think that women know that they can be women and write from a place of what is female in the largest sense.
Never to despise in myself what I have been taught to despise. Not to despise the other, not to despise the it, to make this relation with the it, to know that I am it.
This has been the fourth episode in our series, A Change of World. Honor Moore is our advisor. She's also the editor of the anthology Poems from the Women's Movement, which is published by the Library of America. Thanks to Hannah Brooks Modell for her editorial advice on this episode. Do let us know what you think of this podcast and of this series in particular. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. You can link to the podcast on social media from SoundCloud, or you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.
In the 1960s, radical change came to American poetry.
What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open.
I'm Meryl Streep. Join me for A Change of World, Poetry and the Women's Movement. We'll hear how the women's movement changed poetry and how women poets worked together to change the culture.
Check with your local public radio station to see if they're carrying this hour-long special with Meryl Streep, which, like this podcast, is produced by the Poetry Foundation. If it's not on your radio station's schedule and you want to hear it, please ask them to carry it. It's free to public radio stations, and they can find it on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.